there was such a sense among our pilgrims, and I mean, we had a lot of anxiety because we actually had to run for our lives. Literally, we had to run for our lives. You were there. As it happened, we did run for our lives and made it. But if we hadn't run for our lives, we might have been killed. But there was such a sense that somebody ought to do something, you know, just this instinctive desire that in America this never would have happened because there would have been rules about this and rules about that and rules about this and rules about that. But you walk all through India and nobody can afford to do anything about it is the primary reason. But also there's this other sense that there isn't the necessity that you set up this big system that protects everybody from their own realities. And we have this mindset, and he's talking about it in terms of democracy and so on, but we just have this mindset that somehow the world owes us a kind of security. And we demand it of the government. And the way Swami describes it is that we gradually sell our personal integrity for the sake of that security. Now, he's talking about governments, but you know it's very also true for the devotee. And in that whole section, the temptation, and I'll talk about that, what I mean by that, the temptation to seek material security instead of living faithful to our principles. And one of the other things that Swami talks about is true wealth. His true wealth is the ability to live faithfully to your principles. Because then what you have is a clear conscience. And a clear conscience is worth everything. Swamiji sometimes is so dismissive of popular psychology. He says everybody talks about self-acceptance. He said the only way to have real self-acceptance is to have a clear conscience. Right? Because as long as your conscience is clouded, you will never be at peace with yourself. And I mean, you can have a clear conscience and not be perfect. You can know that you tried and you did your best. But that's a clear conscience too. I tried. I did my best. I was faithful to my principles in that I gave it my best effort. You don't have to be self-realized before you can accept yourself. But there's no shortcut around that. And even a lot of psychology, and we'll talk about that when we get there later, is trying to shortcut it some way. Just trying to say you can compromise your values and it's still okay. We'll make it okay. Sometimes people try to be spiritual and they just tell you, do whatever you want, but just call it spiritual. But it's not true because we're made in a certain way. There are certain realities that will work for us or won't work for us. And Swami's talking about the demise of democracy, talking about how we ask government to help us. Government gets bigger and bigger and has more and more power. And then he says it so simply. Then people in government feel more in tune with big business than they feel in tune with the little person. Because the people who seek to be involved with that are people who like power and like bigness. And people who don't like bigness don't even get involved in it. They want to stay on a human scale. They want to stay where values are more clear and things aren't so compromised. And then you end up with this whole picture, which is really just exactly what we have now. And then he talks about how politicians just start making promises and they start spending our money to do it. And pretty soon we've lost all our principles, our personal integrity. And I was starting to say, as devotees too, it's very tricky business. We have these ideas that we're really trying to live by, that God is our first value, and that our security comes from the divine. And we hit it even within Ananda. It's not like the people of Ananda are already self-realized. This is merely an environment in which we're trying to work together, just as he describes at the end of this. Isn't it better to work with people who are helping you to aspire? And that's exactly what we're working with. But in the last few years, as the population of Ananda begins to age, during the years when I spoke, when we all had nothing, most of us were unmarried. The majority were unmarried. Only a few people had children. I read something in a newsletter, the median age was 25. And people were just young and very, at that time, extremely free. I mean, nowadays, even young people have such strange consciousness from my point of view. I remember talking to a young man of last week. I think I was talking about the woman who was afraid that if she got on this path, she would lose her middle-class dream. I was afraid if I didn't, I would be forced into it. But She was this young man that came here for a while, flirted with the spiritual path, and now has gone on probably to something else, unless God willing he shows up again. But he was about 22 or 23 years old, and he was right in the big tech situation. You know, he was earning more than his father had ever earned, kind of position, and he was very unhappy, and so he was talking to me about, you know, what we were doing and what made it work, and just trying to help find his way a little bit. And I suggested to him, because he had a lot of money in the bank, that he should just maybe go up to Ananda Village for a few months, because I could see, unless he was extricated from his environment, it would be very hard for him to get clarity. And that would mean he would have to leave his job and various things like that. He actually was concerned that if he interrupted his career path or his work, that it would have a deleterious effect on his retirement fund. Yeah. I mean, he was perhaps an extreme example. I said, you haven't yet had a life. You know, we're making decisions about retirement and you haven't had a life. Generally speaking, it's better to have a life before you have a retirement. But it was just like everyone had told him, you do this, you do that, and that's how you run your story. Now, he was not very committed to this path, but as Ananda has aged and the realities of aging and all those things have come to us, there have been all these different movements within Ananda. What about our retirement? And there are different opinions about this, so I'm not going to really say one way or another what people should or shouldn't do. But there was a meeting about retirement, and Nitai, who was one of the virtually a founding member of Ananda and one of the people who really helped develop our school system, was hearing all this about life, members of the monastic order who have worked in Ananda jobs and don't have money in their families, so can't look forward to personal inheritance and, you know, what's going to happen. And there was like, how are we going to provide? What are we going to do? Nitai finally stood up, and it's so movingly and just so truly. And Nitai has been impoverished his whole life. He hasn't had the kind of karma where he tends to end up with lots of money. He's done everything, you know, he lives at a much more gloriously interesting level than most rich people do. But he's not had much in the bank at all. So it was especially meaningful coming from him. And he said, my commitment has never been, it's not been a deal between me and Ananda. He said, my deal has always been with God. And he said, if at the end of a lifetime of service and dedicating myself to the spiritual path, he said, I die impoverished under a bridge. That's just the way it goes. Nobody owes me anything. You know, I'm not going to say at the end, you should take care of me. Nobody should take care of me. He said, I've done this of my own volition, out of the dedication to serving God and Guru, and that's my fate is in his hands. And it is, that's how he lives. But how many times, when we're up against that choice, do we essentially choose security over personal integrity? You see? And we make it as devotees as very small decisions. We believe in, but we also want to be practical. Now, I'm not telling anybody what to do. You know, I'm not describing what I do even or anything like that, but I'm just talking about the principles that Swami's talking about internationally, but yet are just the essence of how our lives are going to work. You know, what do we really believe in, and what is our wealth? If we end up with a comfortable retirement, but we've sacrificed the wealth of what we really wanted, which was to live by what we truly believed and to give our lives to God, will that be a success or failure? Will we be rich or poor? It's a very interesting question, isn't it? And that's really the question that's raised here. And what Swami's trying to say is, break this hypnosis, which everyone has. You know, be the one in a thousand, or the one out of a thousand after that, who really just lives faithful. And that's what wealth is the ability to do that. It's the ability to decide this is what's important to me and to do it. Energy rightly directed. And how do we acquire that? How do we acquire that? You know? What are we devoting our energy to day after day? Acquiring true wealth or accumulating money. It's a fascinating and very, very important, absolutely fundamental to our future and really to the future of the whole world. Well, let's take a short break.
Yes, Steve.
Asha.
Uh-huh.
This is a thought related to the comment you made earlier about Swami's proposal for a tour initially about this book and the fact that it never really came about.
Right.
I've been getting a sense that it's going to be maybe another generation mm-hmm. until these ideas are embraced more fully.
Right.
I think that the generation that's in the universities now is not quite ready for it. And I was thinking maybe karmically there's just some very strong forces moving through this group, and they need to experience perhaps more of this experience of the larger government and those forces in order to get a deeper understanding.
It's possible. I do think that we've certainly seen more spiritual interest in this generation than we saw in other groups. But at the same time, there have been many discussions through the in more recent years at Ananda Villages. We all get older, and there got to be this huge gap that people, we thought that this was such an exciting movement that people would be real interested in it. Several things happened that we failed to perceive, that when young people came, they saw a lot of old people. But they saw their parents, and that wasn't like real exciting to them. The second thing that happens is when something is 30 years old, when you first arrive, you may feel that it's already been done and it doesn't seem that interesting to you. Whereas when you come and it hasn't been done and you're just starting out in your own life, you feel like you have more influence. Also, a very dangerous habit can set in when you yourself have been doing something for a while, that you have a tendency to hold on to your position. And there's just not space, and you get into bad habits. So all of those things have been very relevant. In fact, we had a conversation, a group of us, Sean called it for people who were less than 35, called it for a group of people who were still 35 or less, or maybe just 30 or less. And I was there, not because I am, but because Swami was there, and he took me with him. Sean wasn't going to let me come. But I crashed the party because Swami decided, the party was at his house, and I was staying at his house, and when Swami decided to go to the meeting, he just assumed that I could go. So I just got to walk in under his coattails. But let's see now. The discussion that we were having was when Ananda started years ago as one rural community, it was clearly a revolution. And people don't necessarily see that it's a revolution anymore. And so it's as much of a revolution as it ever was. And for the most part, young people are idealistic and they want a revolution. They want to make the world better. But also, there's another simple fact, which karma is karma. People who are going to be, I mean, this is Master's Ray. This is being a disciple of Yogananda. This is serving this particular expression of God. And if it's your destiny to do it, you'll find it. You'll crack through whatever it is, the superficial, and you'll sense the reality of it. But nonetheless, Swami is fond of quoting Buckminster Fuller's answer when he was being interviewed and someone said, you know, how does it feel to have been propounding these ideas your whole life and nobody's listened to you? He said, oh, it doesn't bother me at all. He says, it always takes at least a generation for a new reality. And Swami explains it perfectly. The old folk have to die. And then a new group grows up with it. I mean, look at the technology. Just the way we all turn to people who are in their 20s to solve, a lot of us to solve our computer problems. I mean, not all of us, but a lot of people who have children just rely on their children. And we sort of say, how do they know that? And they say, well, it's in their cells. It's in their DNA. They just know how to run these machines. And it really is like they're from Atlantis and they created it thousands of years ago, and so they just look at it and it makes perfect sense to them. Whereas some of the rest of us just don't have that same karma. It's just a different thing. We're using it and we're fine with it, but we don't instinctively understand it like we understand other things. But there's a lot of souls that are, you have to say, if this work is going to carry on, there are souls born who are going to do it. Just as simple as that. That doesn't absolve us of responsibility to do our part to make that possible. to get out of the way, to be creative, to, you know, to do all the things that you need to do. But then we'll just see. And if this generation is going to actually face the world that Master keeps promising is going to come, which is a disintegrating reality in which it's not an option anymore. You just don't sort of have this comfortable little materialistic life. It's light and darkness, and you have to decide. And all the security is just whipped out from under you. Then that's a whole different story. We haven't yet seen really what this world is about. And I think a lot of young people who are young now, are really being born for something completely other that they haven't seen yet, which is much better, really, but less comfortable. And we were talking the other night when we were talking about possible war in Iraq, and I was talking about two different incidences that I recall reading about were of men from the Second World War. No, one was from Vietnam, where, you know, Vietnam is, for most people, considered to be, there's very little romantic glamour about Vietnam. There's a great deal of romanticizing of the power of World War II, but there's very little about Vietnam. So this was a Vietnam veteran who had been through some pretty horrific things there. But still said he would happily go back because of the love he experienced. Because he said, in that context, there was nothing superficial. And that was just worth everything. To come back to this life, the worst about this life is that it's so superficial. And people just can't make contact with each other. But there, when he was in Vietnam, everything was absolutely real. Because your life was on the line every day. And that was just much more gratifying. Even though his buddies died and the conditions were terrible. But he said, they'll say lots of things. What is wealth? Has having what you really want. What do you really want? What we want is expansion of consciousness. What we want is happiness and bliss. But we have to, it takes courage. It takes determination. It takes tremendous energy. All kinds of things. And that's why we meditate. And we have to also overcome our subconsciousness. That's why we do Kriya. I've been thinking a lot lately just how much of it is about being trapped in your own samskaras. Your samskaras are the impressions from your past lives. That's what a samskar is. And they're stored in your chakras. It's the vortices of energy in your chakras. Yoga is the neutralization of the vortices of citta, of feeling, of likes and dislikes. It's just overcoming all those whirlpools of karma and being able to really be what we really are. So that's why Kriya is such a revolution. Because Kriya, the technique of Kriya, and of course Kriya initiation technique is the final end of that, but Hong Sa, Om, energization, all the meditation that we learn, the chanting, the prayer, everything is all the dimensions of Kriya. Like Kriya is like the pinnacle, but this is all the mountain that you go up in order to get to the Kriya. But the essence of Kriya is that by the power of concentration, devotion, and the grace of the Guru, you dissolve the karma in your chakras. And when you dissolve the karma in your chakras, you become free. And what you become free to live according to your principles without making the decision to live according to your principles and then suddenly finding yourself over here, not quite sure how you got there. I realized watching myself and other people over the years, I'm just so funny because I'm a procrastinator. And I watch myself head for my computer and suddenly be downstairs at the refrigerator. Not quite sure at what point I came downstairs, you know. And I remember a writer commenting about his tendency to procrastinate. And it was a woman, she said, "Thank God for writing deadlines, otherwise I'd never get my housework done." It's just because, you know, something other takes us in another direction. Somebody told me a chilling story about subconsciousness from the point of view of alcoholism. The man's father had been an alcoholic for a long time and was asserting that he had stopped drinking and had reformed, but he had been drinking for a long time. Many years prior to that. And the son, the story was told by the son, that he was sitting with his father at the table. They were talking about the fact that his father was not drinking anymore. At some point in the meal, his father got up, but he still had alcohol in the house, God knows why. He stood up, he walked over to the sideboard, he poured himself a drink, he drank it, he came back and sat down at the table. And then the son said, "I thought you weren't drinking anymore." Father said, "I'm not." That his subconscious had just taken over and he had just done that, and he wasn't even consciously aware of having done that, because it was just such a habit with him to do that.